Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The corruption trial of former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder has been put on hold after a juror tested positive for COVID-19. Prosecutors last week began to lay out how money flowed from First Energy to Householder in return for him guiding the passage of a nuclear bailout bill. Householder's attorneys say the money trail is not proof of bribery. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us this week, Anna Staber, State House reporter for USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Laura Hancock, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Laura.
Good to be here.
And Julie Carr Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Welcome back, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
And Andy Chow is joining us briefly. He's a reporter for Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. You're not in Cincinnati now, but what's going on down there, Andy Chow?
So like I said, Ann, the trial, after waiting 2.5 years, went on for 2 days and then had to be put on hold again. So after much anticipation, we got a little taste of what was going on, and we got to wait a little bit longer. Hopefully everybody starts to feel better. The jury starts testing negative for things, and we could get back to hearing the argument, which has started with the prosecution presenting their witnesses.
Yeah, they're not done, right? I mean, they're not done kind of rolling out the fundamentals of this yet.
Yeah, so basically their first witness is the person who's setting the narrative throughout the rest of their argument, and that is with Special Agent Blaine Wetzel, who was the person behind writing the 80-page-plus affidavit that we all read back when Householder and the other co-defendants were arrested, and that explains and draws out the details of the accusations against Householder. How the whole bribery scheme came to be. What's interesting now is that now the gloves are off and all the evidence can be presented to the jury. And so while we did read a lot of what was in that case, in that affidavit, now this is more of connecting the dots and really showing you how everything really kind of fell into place and why the prosecution decided to move forward with these charges.
So far, Anna Staber, have there been any surprises?
Not yet. I mean, Blaine, when he was testifying, only got up to about, I would say, February of 2017. So that's still, I mean, this is before Larry is speaker. This is before the passage of the now infamous House Bill 6. They were sort of, I think, setting the foundation of the relationship. So it was how he flew to Trump's inauguration on a First Energy plane, how they went out to some very expensive steakhouses, like who was on that plane, like. And I think that was starting to show, like, this is how the relationship between Larry and First Energies got started.
And wait, so,
yeah, go ahead, Andy.
And what Anna just described, I think, is going to be key for the prosecution. What they said in their opening statements, what the prosecution said, is that when you're following a bribe, you never have somebody say, here, I'm giving you money. This is a bribe. Now do this for me. Instead, they say it's because of a series of events that happen where you can connect the dots, and it starts with this trip on a private jet with First Energy executives to DC, then sitting out to dinner, and according to the prosecution and according to the witness, plotting out a specific design of how Householder can rise to power, become speaker, and pass what became HB6.
Yeah, Julie Carr Smythe.
And what was also interesting is some documents that were internal to the dark money group called Generation Now and Jeff Longstreth, the aide to Householder, who has pleaded guilty, that were showing a clear ambition on the part of Larry Householder to become the speaker, to the point where the three initials that he was using in all of his private communications were SLH, Speaker Larry Householder. He was not yet speaker. I mean, he had been in the past.
Yeah.
But, you know, and they had something called Operation Rewrite History with all kinds of tentacles of how they were going to carry out this. They will say plan, the government will say plot to achieve his power and so forth. So all this is going on in the backdrop. And there were actually two witnesses before the FBI agent, one from First Energy. He's the current treasurer and was at the time and talked about how the company was desperate. The company was bleeding cash, needed to get rid itself.
So what's another $61 million dollars, I guess.
Right. And so we need the $1 billion bailout, so we're going to spend the $60 million to get it. But, you know, he was basically talking about the nuclear situation at the time was causing them to be desperate as well. So,
and there was a little bit of a dust up there, right? Because the deferred prosecution agreement, where First Energy admits to that this was a bribe, isn't going to be coming as evidence in the trial. But there was some, right, correct me if I'm wrong, Andy, and there was a little bit of back and forth about whether when to tell the jury that just because somebody is testifying doesn't mean they're not guilty, basically, and like how to, and that if they went down a certain line of questioning, like at a certain point, if the defense steps in it, the prosecution will be able to introduce it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of what can be admitted as evidence, what cannot be admitted as evidence. There was actually, as another example, right before opening statements began, the prosecution filed to have a big portion of Larry Householder's opening statements inadmissible because of certain communications that they wanted to share between certain members who are co-defendants, associates. And so there's a lot of strategizing when it comes to, of course, both sides arguing their case and what can be, what cannot be. They all came to certain stipulations of what can be entered into the record and what cannot be.
Before I let you go, I wanted to talk about the logistics of covering a trial like this in a federal courtroom. Andy Chow, it is not easy. You can't not depend on the public to be supplementing with their own listening or viewing.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that the federal court rules make it so that we cannot record anything. We cannot take any pictures. So when we go in, we've just got a pen and a paper, writing down as many notes as possible, and then bringing it to the public afterwards. It was a weird feeling when I was sitting next to the sketch artist in the room and thought, it's 2023, and here we are relying on this person with a bunch of colored pencils to tell us the look of things in this courtroom. During a very big, the largest corruption scandal case in Ohio history, we're all depending on drawings and pen and paper.
Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks for your insights. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ann.
What do you guys think? I mean, what do you think about how covering something like this and getting it through to people in like he said, with colored pencils and pen and paper?
Right. It's very difficult for us. There was an overflow room where we could listen to the testimony so we could have our laptops and be able to type notes, but we weren't allowed to record, which is kind of a mainstay for journalists, just to make sure we get the quotes, full quotes, and get mm-hmm. them right. And I understand, because the Judge Black continually, was reminding the jury, keep an open mind. You're hearing one side first, then you're going to hear the other side. Don't read anything. Don't look at Twitter. Don't look at social media. That's hard in today's world. And
yeah.
So I think he's feeling he wants to try his best not to make a media circus of it. But for us in the professional field that are trying to just tell an accurate story, it is pretty difficult.
What's it like in there?
So the overflow room is piped in from upstairs. You cannot see the exhibits, but you can see the you can hear the testimony. You can see the person who's asking the questions. When you go upstairs to the courtroom, the gallery was masked, which is interesting given the COVID situation. The gallery was masked, but the jurors and the witnesses and the defendants were not masked, nor the judge. So I don't know what the implications are there. But basically, it was pretty calm. And at one point, however, the Householder team got chastised by the judge because they were clicking pens and murmuring. And I don't know if they were heckling the assistant U.S. attorney, but she had asked the judge, please tell them to be quiet. I'm giving my opening arguments.
Yeah, Laura Hancock?
Larry Householder has said he would like to testify, and so it'll be really interesting if he does take the stand.
Yes, it will.
He is trying to present himself as like an everyman. So one day we got a photo of him walking outside the courthouse in a suit, and then he's wearing like a Hunter orange Carhartt hat on top. So it'll be very interesting. No word on whether or not Matt Borges wants to testify or whether they will put him on the stand.
And I will say, Matt was very kind of mom through when he would move through the halls and the elevators. Larry was not. Larry was super chatty, very trying to be Larry, being mm-hmm. personable with the press, schmooze us and basically say, you know, listen, you guys, I completely understand that you've only told one side so far. It's all you had. We've had to be quiet for 2.5 years, but I'm beseeching you to be fair, tell my side. And, you know, I think his defense team was trying to paint him for like almost an hour. They just were going on about his biography until the judge had to say, listen, talk about the evidence. Talk about what this case is about and
this
stop.
This is the sentencing part.
Right.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, juries, sometimes it's likability. And I think that's going to be really interesting if Larry takes the stand. Because regardless about how you feel about him politically, like, I assume, just having covered him, he is really gregarious and friendly and outgoing. And he has spent a lifetime learning how to answer questions and how not to answer questions and how to dodge potentially like gotcha questions from media, so to speak. Like, he has so much practice for being on the stand, like probably 30 years worth of practice. It will be really interesting. I actually think it could be to his advantage to testify.
He said at the outset, not of the trial, but of when the charges were leveled and so on, and after he was arrested and released on bail and everything, that he was going to travel the state, you know, and tell his story. He never did that, and I assume his lawyers had a hand in that, the muting of Larry Householder, and I wonder if they might not.
Even the first day when we were talking to him and he was, you know, starting to attract a crowd and starting to have reporters asking him about his behavior and his acts and all that stuff, and his lawyer kind of came over, I need to speak to you, Mr. Speaker, and like dragged him away.
What do we know about what the two that took that have admitted their roles and took a deal? What do we know about the deals? Anything yet?
Not yet. I have to assume it'll come out during testimony or cross-examination. They'll want to be like, hey, what did you get for your testimony? Try and smear them a little bit with what they got.
You mean take them down a notch? This would be on the part of the defense team.
I don't know if the prosecution will proactively walk them through like what they got, but I have to imagine that federal racketeering charges, which is what both Borges and Householder are facing. They're facing a single count, so it's very all or nothing. But it can carry 20 years in prison. Like, it is serious. There are big fines. Like, if they have to pay any kind of restitution, like, it's, I mean, sometimes if you take the calculus, like, you know, do I want to roll the dice on 20 or maybe take a year that I know is guaranteed? I don't know. We're going to find out, though, when they testify, I think, one way or the other.
Right. And it's very important because as the U.S. Attorney's Office, the federal prosecutors made clear, any person, attached to a bribery scheme is equally culpable. It's one for all and all for one. So, you know, the people who pleaded guilty, the two aides, and the nonprofit would have been up for that same 20 years.
I guess the point being that not everybody shared equally in the benefits of this scheme, but everybody gets equal blame.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like if you're the getaway driver in a murder,
can
be charged with murder.
Right. Let's take a quick break. We have been talking about the corruption trial of former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder. Also, the former chair of the Ohio Republican Party is on trial, both for racketeering and a case evolves from an effort by First Energy to get a nuclear bailout bill passed in the Ohio General Assembly. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The divisions among Republicans in the State House were on full display last week. Again, Ohio's new Speaker of the House, Republican Jason Stevens, squared off with a group of fellow Republicans that called themselves the Republican Majority Caucus during what is usually a pro forma vote on rules and committee appointments. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Lori Hancock, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press, and Anna Staver, State House reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Anna, what's going on with the Republicans in the Ohio House? It's everything's still in play, kind of, right?
They
didn't make nice yet.
No. So, like, the 30-second backstory for anyone who hasn't been following it is that Republicans have 67 of the 99 House seats. So they got a supermajority, and they get to pick the Speaker. But they voted in caucus, so all together they voted in November for a guy named Derek Marin. Then we come to January, the official vote at the start of the new session, and a group of them breaks off. Now, you could say they had buyer's remorse, maybe they went rogue, it sort of depends on your interpretation. But 22 of them aligned with the Democrats to create a new majority and elect a guy named Jason Stevens. But the 45 who stuck with Marin, well, it was 43, two were missing. But anyways, they feel like what Stevens did was inappropriate. We had a caucus vote, we chose somebody, then you partnered with the Democrats, and there's been this big question about what was the deal? How did he get the Democrats on board? Now, the Democrats say there was no grand deal. I don't know. I feel like there was some kind of negotiation, no matter how official. But then when it came to making the rules, Marin and his group wanted some concessions. They wanted to weaken the power of the House Speaker. They wanted more say for individual members. Now, with the householder trial going on, they've got a good backdrop of saying, hey, we had a dictator of a speaker and we got corruption. Like, perhaps we should change this. Stevens didn't entertain any of it. He gaveled them down. He didn't even, like, allow debate on the rules. And the Marin group is pissed. Representative Phil Plummer went so far as to say Stevens should resign.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the people in the Marin group who was trying to make an amendment to the rules was Josh Williams, and he's an African American. And there's sort of like this history on the House floor of Black members who've mostly are Democrats being sort of gaveled down, ignored, belittled, that kind of thing. And so, like, the Ohio Christian Alliance sent out an email after that saying, once again, a Black person is rejected. Another interesting thing.
Williams said it himself afterwards.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing is Ron Ferguson, who's part of the Marin group, he wanted to do an amendment saying it should only be Christian prayer that opens up each session. They also did
that's one of the rules they were voting on. Mm-hmm. Or they proposed.
Yeah, and that was totally ignored. The Democrats were horrified, and even some Republicans, such as Bill Seitz, who's, you know, a longtime member in leadership, he was like, this is insulting to our Jewish and Muslim members who are in this chamber. So that didn't go.
And there was another thing about guns on the floor. They wanted to vote on guns on the floor.
And I'll say, like, so I used to work in Western legislatures. That's common out there. Like, Colorado allows carry for members and people with offices inside the building. Oregon allows members of the public to open carry inside their state house. So that's, like, I know some people are like, hey, that's really weird. But it's actually, like, there is precedent. There are, like, several state legislatures that permit this. Ohio's kind of unique in that you can carry guns almost anywhere except the state house.
Right. You can't even bring them in the state house, let alone bring them on the floor.
Right.
Gosh, can you imagine?
Well, and so as Anna says, the thing about the grand deal showed up in these rules as well, because they give an awful lot of power to the minority leader, the leader of the Democrats, Alison Russo. So, you know, rather than deferring on every single thing that relates to the Democratic members, deferring to the Speaker, she will be able to decide which of her members go on the committees. She'll be consulted on various other.
That's not typical.
Well, it was a change to the rules under householder, pardon me, at least, because that would be, you can recommend to the Speaker, but he's going to have the ultimate choice. So she got some of that, and then we'll find out Wednesday whether or not this other piece of it, which was that Brian Stewart, who had sponsored the 60% supermajority proposal that would change how constitutional amendments are,
make it harder to get them through.
He believes and has confirmed that he thinks that Stevens bartered that away in order to win this.
Well, I mean, to be fair, so Stevens had a brown bag lunch with reporters on Friday. And one of the things he said on the record was that when it comes to amending the Constitution, he didn't think it was appropriate to do it in May because not every county votes in May. They would have to spend money to vote that people don't know it's an election. He was pretty clear on the record that he thought it was inappropriate to do then and that he would be okay with November. So,
yeah, except that it could be in competition with other things on the ballot. That is exactly what they're trying to keep from getting passed.
Yeah, but I mean, keep in mind, he was a county auditor and a county commissioner.
Yeah, he's a local guy.
Yeah, and his argument was that this would cost local governments a lot more money to run an election like this, and most people probably wouldn't even know it was happening.
So this is one of the areas in which Stevens' greater experience in government and presumably reasonableness, if that's a word, were why some of these folks aligned with him, from what my interviewing has suggested.
He was able to get the rules passed 63-35, so there were some Republicans that, even though they backed Marin, were willing to vote with him on the rules.
Yeah, there were some like Representative Hoops and others who got some committee chairmanships and things, and like I think Marin has long said that if you get offered a leadership position, like you should take it. And so I'm sure that was part of it. But 35 is still a majority of the caucus. It's a much smaller one, but it's still, there's 67 total. So it's still like 35-32 in that situation.
Hmm. That may have just been a practicality. Like, I'm not going to go to the mat for every single procedural thing that happens, even if I support Marin and his positions on leadership.
What are the expectations, Laura Hancock, as far as the issues that they'll take up with this great divide?
I don't know. I mean, if the Republicans were united, they could pass every bill without the roughly 90-day period it takes for it to go into effect after the governor's...
Every bill could be an emergency bill.
Right, which could, you try to get a referendum through in that period of time. Well, that would kill off any referendum effort. But because they're so divided, we don't know if that's going to really happen. I mean, back to kind of the argument between Derek Marin and Speaker Stevens. Speaker Stevens, during his brown bag on Friday, whipped out the credit card with his name on it. For the fundraising committee for Ohio House Republicans.
Oh, yeah, there's the money.
Because Derek Marin nominated, was it Phil Plummer?
Yes.
To be chairman of the committee that handles all that fundraising.
The pile of money chairman.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, no, it's like Alliance now, right? It's been
O-Rah. Yeah. O-Rah.
It's pile of money. Oh,
Ohio House Republican Alliance.
Yeah.
Money.
I just like O-Rah.
And so, but, you know, Stevens is like... He shows the credit card and says, nope, my name is literally on the credit card. I have control of the money. Nice try. So that will be interesting as well.
Yeah.
So
how much just money are we talking about?
Well, they spent about, we think, $4.5 million in the election last time. And, you know, it's the kind of thing, it's a caucus account. There's allowed to be one under the code. And a lot of members will put their little extra money in there, like say, hey, I have a really cool gerrymandered district and I don't need this cash, so I'll just give it to that for anyone who needs it. And Marin was one of the big beneficiaries of it, I believe.
Yeah, he was. And, you know, RSC code, as Julia was saying, actually is pretty vague on how these get administered. So every caucus, so like Republican, Democrat in the House and Senate, gets one official. But the code says that the caucus decides how it is to be administered. And that's all it says, is that the caucus decides. And Plummer and Marin's
argument... But it doesn't define the caucus necessarily?
It just does the people who caucus. Like, if you're a registered Republican, okay, you're a member of that caucus.
A caucus is defined as all the members
of a
single party.
Okay.
So technically, it doesn't have to be anybody in the House who administers it, because it just says as they decide to do it. And so Plummer and Marin's position is, we have a majority of the caucus. We have voted that Phil Plummer will run it. Now, arguably that's true, but I don't know what happens if, like, Representative Plummer might have to take Speaker Stevens to court to fight out who has control of O-Rah if he really wants to take it that far.
Super fun. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Anna Staver, State House reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Also with us, Laura Hancock, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, and Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Money makes the world go round, and they're already running for re-election at this point, ultimately.
And Anna and I were talking a little bit before the show. Of course, you can start an independent committee outside of this. It's called a legislative campaign fund under the law, and put as much money and direct people there if you want. Go back to segment one. That's what Larry Householder did, and it didn't go so well. So, you know, we have to, and it could be that the scenario is Marin starts one and so does Stevens. And, you know, that really dissipates their power and their ability. What's interesting on your earlier question about their agenda, my understanding is none of this is that policy related, that these are conservatives fighting with conservatives. They all want the same things. They want a total ban on abortion. They want maybe right to work, whatever. I mean, some of the stuff is maybe a little more conservative in Marin's caucus, but I don't know if you guys disagree, but I from what I've heard, it's not really a policy.
It's a power issue.
The only thing where I've heard a real difference is Stevens is not convinced that universal voucher is appropriate at this time, that he thinks it's something maybe we could move towards.
But as far as education goes, yeah.
That he's a little more concerned about like universal education savings accounts or universal vouchers. So, but Marin had been very pro backpack bill, so that may be one policy divide, but it's not like Stevens opposes school choice.
And backpack bill being that you can carry the money with you wherever you go. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's a difference in tax policy, you know, again, kind of nuanced. Derek Marin would like to totally get rid of the state income tax. However, that would be really hard to figure out how to replace that. And then Stevens just wants to simplify it.
That's interesting.
Or, yeah, move toward a flat tax.
Flat tax, yeah.
So the other thing about Derek Marin and this whole, like, account for fundraising, that is just, I don't fully understand. Derek Marin's in for 2 years, and then he's term limited. And so, you know, like, Householder had his own, like, committee where he was raising money for candidates who supported him to become speaker. But Householder had, like, a future. He was not term limited at the time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Derek Marin, this is probably a power move more than anything, because as far as the long term, Marin is going to have to either run for the Senate or leave the legislature.
That's a great point, because that committee is a campaign committee. So it would be to raise money for 2 years from now. So as a speaker, why would Marin be so adamant?
Yeah.
Well, it would be Phil Plummer running it, and he has 2 more years after these two.
So on behalf of Phil Plummer,
issue. Well, Plummer did want to be speaker. So it could be more about Phil Plummer's future. But I don't know. Marin could also run against Kaptur. He's in that district.
And Marcy Kaptur up along the lakeshore. Where does this leave Democrats in an interesting place? They don't really have to say anything.
Yeah, they've been kind of quiet. But like I said, they got a little bit more power out of this. And I think that they're going to be kind of pivotal, because Stevens is not in great shape with his own caucus in terms of knowing, you know, he'll still try to figure out how they're going to vote, and I believe try to push their bills over Democratic bills, but we don't really know yet, do we?
No.
Have there been any regular House sessions yet?
No.
Because I was wondering what the mood and the atmosphere might be in that place.
They haven't even had any bills introduced. I mean, there's a bunch being drafted, but there are no House bills. I mean, the Senate has over 24. The House doesn't have any.
Because the rules that we just saw go into place last week, that was like the prerequisite. You have to set the rules before the introduction of bills. And so Stevens has said, though, they're going to get the budget tomorrow, right, from the governor. He's going to introduce his budget. It goes to the House. It gets introduced as is to be changed. And Stevens is of the opinion, like, we're going to get the budget. We're going to get in bills. We're going to start working. And he thinks that, like, things will settle as we actually, like, move on to the nuts and bolts of, say, like, passing legislation.
And they've got the committee assignments
made.
Yes, they do.
He's got a ton of new committees.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, he's got one committee that's just based on like constitutional amendments. Mm-hmm. And Gail Manning, the one that kind of floored me was Gail Manning, who is a retired like kindergarten teacher, very knowledgeable on education, Republican from Northeast Ohio. She is not chairing education anymore. They have Adam Bird chairing education.
Who's that?
Conservative dude.
Okay. But he was a superintendent of a public school, so he's not like unqualified in the sense of like an educational background.
But the vice chair of that committee is Sarah Arthur Fowler. She's the one who went on TV in Cleveland and said schools needed to tell, quote, both sides of the Holocaust, including the side from the German soldier. She's the vice chair of the education committee. Yay. And Gail Manning is in charge of a higher education committee.
Which is an interesting move because she was a public school teacher. Not at the. I don't think Gail was ever, Representative Manning was ever at the collegiate level. I could be wrong, absolutely. But I don't know how that's all going to shake out. The other thing to keep in mind, and I had a story out this morning, is that, yeah, he's created, I think, four new committees and two new finance subcommittees. Now, he gave a lot of reasons why he thinks these are important new committees, like splitting health, because there's a lot of like divisive health. So there's like health policy and then a scope of practice committee. And he's like, look, we got bogged down in a lot of debates over like vaccines or transgender medical care, and having one that deals with more like not controversial health policy might be more efficient. But these also mean more money, because you get like $9,000 extra a year as a committee chair. You get like 67.
Spreads the wealth. Who pays for that? Taxpayers?
We do. Yeah. I think I'm trying to remember the math from my story this morning, but like he also raised the per diem for hotels and for mail sent to constituents. So it's a little over $500,000 over 2 years in extra like taxpayer dollars for the cost of the house now.
We will take a break. Coming up, we're going to look at what to expect from Governor DeWine's State of the State address this week. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Laura Hancock, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com, Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press, and Anna Staver, Statehouse reporter for the USA Today Network, Ohio. The State of the State address is scheduled for tomorrow, Tuesday. Governor DeWine said recently that his address will focus on his budget priorities for the next 2 years. What are his budget priorities, Julie Carr-Smythe?
Well, we have heard that he is very interested in mental health, and he's going to make that a definite priority. I think he'll extend his commitment in that way to his children's agenda, which has always been sort of a priority.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think we may see, you know, every budget they've raised the income guidelines for subsidized child care. He's done like, you know, specific wraparound services for schools. These are the things that happen outside the classroom, like access to counselors, which may tie in with that mental health. We're definitely going to see a lot of that. I also think, you know, he's thinking towards legacy. This is, you know, I mean, he gets one more budget after this, but
this is last, yeah.
Yeah, these are his last 4 years in office. You know, in his inauguration speech, he talked a lot about building something for the future. It's sort of like, you know, planting something he doesn't intend to reap, basically, and setting that sort of stage, because we're flush with cash right now. That's a nice place to be. And, you know, it's possible for him to do a little extra spending in perhaps some of these like more foundational issues.
The Rainy Day Fund now has $3.5 billion. That's an all-time high for Ohio. All sorts of organizations are now calling and writing, asking for help.
Well, yeah, it's a good, it is a happy place to be, but it does create that kind of a dynamic. One of the number one bill coming out of the Ohio Senate, you know, they number them, and the number one bill, which is signals the highest priority, is revamping the approach to education, shifting power from the Ohio State Board of Education to the executive branch, which a lot of governors have always wanted. None have ever been able to achieve it. I'm really curious what your thoughts are about whether that's achievable. And let's start with whether or not the governor is going to address that in his State of the State address.
I don't know if he's going to bring it up in the State of the State address, but I think it could end up in the budget. Like, I think...
Like his budget?
Possibly, or because Stevens, Speaker Stevens is interested in it. It's Matt Huffman's priority bill. Mm-hmm. He's the Senate president. So the big three are all in on doing this kind of change. And part of it is also the non-controversial part, is splitting the Ohio Department of Education into like one deputy director who focuses on traditional K-12 and one that focuses on education workforce. So trade schools, you know, post-secondary that's not college, like having that real focus on that sort of technical training. And people say that's a long time coming. That's really important, especially with people like companies like Intel coming in. So I think we could see and alluding to that because, I mean, DeWine helped shepherd the Intel deal, the Honda expansion. And those companies are saying, like, we need more qualified, trained people in the state of Ohio.
There appears to be a mismatch of people's skills and professional experience and what's actually the hot in-demand jobs. So a realignment could be beneficial. Yeah, and that's about the least controversial. The rest of that bill is a little bit more controversial because the concern is, you know, that education can become politicized. I mean, just
could.
As opposed to isn't?
Yeah. More politicized, I guess. Thank you. Because, you know, certain, like, critical race theory, you know, how you teach race.
Which is not taught in Ohio schools right
now.
No
schools. Yeah. But people who are critical of it don't even like teachers to do diversity, you know, and inclusion, like, professional training. So you could have, you know, a rewrite of history. I mean, my sister lives in Texas, and she was like, there's how they teach the Alamo in public schools, and there is how I teach my daughter by going to the library and getting books, the truth, you know? So,
interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, and you have, like, I mean, in Florida, I think a lot of people saw that, you know, the AP history, African American studies class, Florida is not going to allow any students to do it. Their Department of Education said it violated law. So, I mean, we could head toward that.
So the element here that between the policy and the politics is, you know, as they're both alluding, like, sort of governors have always been frustrated because this is third most expenditures in the state budget after Medicaid and prisons, I think. And, you know, they don't have a lot of control. They want to have some philosophical control over, as Anna points out, something like just how are we directing our education resources to the right places for the right things for our economy and our state. That is legitimate. But the way that our board is selected has always been viewed as being able to sort of dampen some of the hyper political stuff, because there are people who are elected by the general electorate. There are people who are appointed. There are people, you know, mm-hmm. who serve at large and people who serve districts. And so it's a unique animal that sort of allows the politics to dissipate a little bit, which is, I think, what Laura was getting at.
Some people thought it became somewhat dysfunctional in recent years.
Yeah, I say that the board perhaps has done themselves no favors when it comes to how they've picked the new state superintendent. So the state superintendent is essentially the head of ODE. And the board gets to pick somebody and they vote. And it's been almost it'll be 2 years this summer that Paula DiMaria, the previous state superintendent, announced his retirement. And we still don't have a permanent new state superintendent. They picked one person who had to resign within 2 weeks because of ethics concerns. So he had been on the board and there were some questions about
he'd
whether
been
he
on
could
the
do
search committee.
Yes.
The board.
So there was some serious questions about whether he could serve. So he's like, you know what? I'm going to resign. I'm not going to take any money. We're just going to. And then they've been going back and forth now on debating for months how to start the search over again. Now, to be fair, this bill has come up to remake the Department of Education. And the board is like, should we be searching for a superintendent who may, for all intents and purposes, become a figurehead? Because it changes the scope of the job.
Would
and
there
the pool
still
of applicants.
Be, in the Senate bill, would there still be a state superintendent?
Yeah, there
yes.
would.
Okay.
I think that's constitutional. So like...
So the what they would do is they would be the secretary to the board, and they would be an advisor to the Department of Education and Workforce leader, cabinet position. And so that person, you know, there's a lot of discussion about how this would actually look.
How much it would actually cost.
Yeah. I would think the superintendent job would get a massive pay cut, because right now it's over $200K. That's what Paula was paid.
And it's hard enough to find him as it is.
Yeah.
Now.
I assume the director would get that level, and that this person would probably get bumped down to like $100K. I think it could be a real change in, and that would change the pool of applicants. Like,
exactly.
You might want to be the director mm-hmm. if that's the power position.
Yeah, I asked Andrew Brenner last.
State this is the Senator, second, who's the Education Committee Chair, right?
Right, and this is the second time we've seen this bill. And I asked him last time, you know, are members, like employees of the Ohio Department of Education going to have to reapply for their jobs, you know? And he said, I don't see how that, you know, would be necessary. We'll see about that. I mean, there have been quite a few people leaving that department just in the last couple months, I think, seeing... that mm-hmm. it's not a stable place. So,
well, yeah, because you'll have two new deputy directors, and then it's a question of who goes where.
Yeah, it's education is once again reared its ugly head in the state of Ohio.
The other thing,
it's gonna be interesting to see how it all pans out.
The other thing to note is just one of the things that Andrew Brenner, the Senate Education Committee Chair, keeps saying is that if we don't like what the governor is doing, we're going to pass a bill to like straighten it out. And so then it's like, this will just be different fighting, but still fighting over education policy. And Governor DeWine, I don't know if I foresee him doing some crazy radical changes to state education, maybe, or how history's taught or something. But like, I don't know about the legislature. You know, I don't know if I trust them to not try to get into the weeds of that kind of stuff.
What, so I'm kind of interested, not to go off on this again, but that the governor, he stands to gain a lot of influence over education with Senate Bill 1, but you're thinking he's not going to necessarily mention it in the State of the State?
I think, I mean, he's been cautious to say that this is something that he would like, that this is something okay. that all governors prior to him would have liked. Like, Kasich made a run at this, too. I think he's just hesitant to be like, this is my thing and I want this thing. I think he's being smart in sort of letting the legislature take the lead, in part because there were certain conservatives in the House who were hesitant to give him this control, who still have maybe some bad feelings about how he handled COVID, about how he might handle this issue. I think him staying a little quiet is like letting the legislature work it out.
We saw him, you know, it kind of imploded last time. And, you know, he has an interest in not looking like he's behind bills that are going to fail, you know, as we've seen with his gun control proposals that really never went anywhere to the extent that he wanted them to. And they were all sort of what John Kasich had put a committee together to call common sense, bipartisan, easy stuff to do. And it is not easy for DeWine to do it.
We don't know also what the public thinks about this idea. I'm guessing most people don't even know or are aware of it. So
about changing the leadership of education in mm-hmm. Ohio.
But I think that people who've had a problem with the schools and have had to involve their local school board member might not be a fan. We don't know what public polling is showing. So if he's going to bring this up, why bring up something so negative when State of State tends to be okay. kind of heartwarming and, you know.
Aspirational.
Really?
I told my editor I was so excited for the State of the State. And she said, this is why I, you know.
Yeah, this is why you do what you do.
Why you do what you do.
I don't know. I always find those kind of things. They signal things and they tell us things about the people. A new Ohio Senate bill will prohibit investment managers of several state funds. Do you guys know this?
Mm-hmm.
from engaging in so-called ESG investing. Mm-hmm. Lori Hancock, you're nodding your head the most vigorously.
ESG investments are investments that are taken with environmental, social, and corporate governance policies in mind. So say your thing is you want more women on corporate boards. That would be an ESG investment. So you either
You look for companies to invest in that have more women on their boards.
Yeah, I mean, okay. That would be an example.
Yeah, gotcha. So
you either go look at companies with good, strong ESG policies that you agree with, or there are several independent agencies that rate like mutual funds. So you would look for a mutual fund. Some people say it's like greenwashing.
Well, just for older people out there, it would be like it would be like saying you can't divest mm-hmm. in companies that do business with South Africa.
Right. So basically,
same thing.
Like 2 weeks ago, I mean, this is like a thing nationally. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of conservative legislatures are ordering their state government funds to get out of ESG investing. Ohio's not doing any of it. So this might be a conservative dog whistle type situation, or maybe it's trying to stop something before it starts. But this would involve all five retirement pension systems, and it would involve.
What do they say about this?
I mean, you're not really hearing anything from them. I think this is not something they want to fight the legislature. I mean, nobody's doing these investments in Ohio. Now, like Ron DeSantis calls it like woke investing. So that's kind of the idea, you know, is they don't like it because it's
because it's what?
Because it's too liberal. It's too caring about climate change is woke, you know? And now the argument for it is like these are not short sellers. These are long-term investments. And when you're an institutional investor with billions of dollars, I mean, you have to remember OPERS, the Ohio Public Employees Retirement System, is the 14th largest retirement system in the country. Mm-hmm. So when they look at a company and think we want to buy some shares, they have much influence to say like, hey, what are you doing for the future? What are you doing? And so that's the argument in favor of it. Mm-hmm. You know, is leave the world a little bit of a better place. The bill is written that all they have to do, the fund managers just have to make sure that they're investing in the funds that make the most money. But when you look at ESG, I mean, everybody who's doing ESG, you know,
it's not a bad investment.
No, they're not doing charity work. I mean, they're still trying to make money. Mm-hmm. Federal law says if you are a fund manager, you have fiduciary responsibility to make your people money.
So ESG reviews do not include any conservative values, like this is a company that has supported gun rights or abortion.
I think it can on like a personal level. So like correct me if I'm wrong, Laura, but I don't think the bill addresses like personal investment. So like if you have a 401k or you have a 529 for your children, you can choose these kinds of investments now. And there are like the environmental version. Yeah, this only applies to large government funds. So, you know, it's sort of saying like you can do this with your own money and say, I don't want to invest in these kinds of places. And you can find like the investors who will do that, or the companies in particular that you want to invest in. What they're trying to prevent, I guess, is these large scale, massive, multi-billion dollar funds from making that kind of choice that like we all theoretically can make.
Yeah, it's the five retirement systems, any investments that all the colleges and universities have, and Bureau of Workers' Compensation Fund are the ones that are affected.
We're running out of time, but Julie, the city of Lebanon in southwest Ohio recently narrowed its law restricting abortion after an effort by abortion rights advocates. Can you give us a thumbnail on what happened down there?
Yes, it's an interesting sort of national test case to me because Lebanon outlawed all abortions and also aiding and abetting abortion, which was the bigger concern to these social
kind of
workers.
Adopted to Texas.
Right, right. Yeah. And it's been spreading. I mean, they have it now in 65 cities in I think, one county across the country. So Lebanon got rid of this. They sued. And what happened was that they had to put it on hold. They decided not to defend the ban, which was challenged under some different things than Roe v. Wade would have been. You know, due process, things like that. And so now they've taken the aiding and abetting prohibition out of it, which says, you know, okay, they were worried people be criminally charged if they advise someone on this, or if they drove them to Cincinnati, or if they provided them a bus or whatever. And so the sponsor of the so-called sanctuary city bill says he doesn't think they've relinquished anything, but The lawsuit's gone.
That's Julie Carr Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Also, Anna Staver, Statehouse reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. And Laura Hancock, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. I appreciate it. Thanks to everybody else out there for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.